This episode is brought to you by Mountain Sea Media. I spent half my life near the Pacific Ocean and the other half in the mountains of Central Oregon. These places are full of profound stories and experiences that guide my life, even now as a media creator and a beer professional. This is how Mountain Sea Media was born. I realized how impactful stories are to our lives and business. Stories share good experiences and the warmth of friends. They improve business by sharing these experiences and connecting deeply with our customers. If you'd like to connect better with your customers through copywriting and storytelling, contact me at jeremy@mountainseamedia.com. It's your story. I'll help you tell it.
Welcome to episode 35 of Good Beer Matters.
Stick by stick and tank by tank, including the malt mill I built from scratch. Pretty rough, those are early years, just kind of build the awareness. The world right now for the drinker is probably as good as it's ever been.
I read a quote online recently that goes, "Challenges are what makes life interesting, and overcoming them is what makes life meaningful." It made me think back to the early days before the craft beer movement was a thing. In the 60s and 70s, homebrewing was illegal, ingredients were hard to come by, equipment was built by hand, information was scarce, and nobody drank dark, flavorful beer. To say that our early craft beer pioneers surmounted some steep challenges is a bit watered down. I had the opportunity to talk to one of those early pioneers, Ken Grossman, who is a brewing icon, founder, and owner of Sierra Nevada Brewing. Join us as he shares his thoughts on how overcoming challenges has shaped the past, the present, and will even shape the future of craft beer. My name is Jeremy. I'm a certified Cicerone, BJCP judge, IBD certified brewer, and a beer writer. I believe the art, the science, and the culture of beer has more of a profound effect on us than we realize. I believe there's a world of wisdom found in every glass, and I intend to get to the bottom of it. This is Good Beer Matters. These are the stories of us, of great food and the beer that brings it all together. I hope you enjoy episode 35 of Good Beer Matters with Ken Grossman of Sierra Nevada Brewing.
Thank you so much for being part of this Good Beer Matters podcast. I've been looking forward to chatting with you and getting your insight for a very, very long time now. And I know you have given many interviews over your many years of brewing, and I hope that we'll dive into some topics that you don't regularly get into. I'm looking to flesh out some different kinds of stories, but thank you for being here.
I can't wait. Let's talk about beer.
Let's talk about beer. I suspect that you've talked about beer many times in your life, but it probably never gets old, does it?
No, I've really been fascinated with the whole alchemy of brewing for many, many years, and certainly have watched our fledgling industry go from just a handful of us back in 1980 to more than 7,000 today. So I've witnessed quite a transformation and evolution of the brewing industry.
Yeah, and actually, I would love for you to just give a little bit of an introduction or just kind of a little background. I think you'd do a way better job than I would of your tenure in beer.
Well, so I started, the best of my recollection and from some notes I found a few years back, 1969 started home brewing, and I had a neighbor a few doors down whose son and I were best buddies in elementary school, and I was always hanging around his house, and his father, Cal, was quite accomplished brewer for that era. He made beer, wine, sake, had a little distillation set up. He was just into fermentation, and he had a buddy who worked at one of the major breweries, and so he could get, at that point, great ingredients, which weren't widely available. There were a few homebrew supply shops. The home wine shop down in Southern California was where the Maltose Falcons, which was the first homebrew club, was founded. And that came a number of years after he was a pretty serious home brewer. He was part of that Malto's Falcons club. But he was a grain brewer back, I think, very early on when he was in college. And so I think in the 50s he was making homebrew and had access to some ingredients from a major brewer. So he was able to get yeast and great hops and malt and things that weren't widely available to a normal home brewer. And since he was a scientist, a metallurgist by trade, he took a scientific approach to brewing. So I was growing up down the street, and I would be at his house, and quite often on weekends there was a pot of wort boiling on the stove, and so I got the smells and sights of home brewing at quite an early age. The steps I went from there to start home brewing myself, I went down to the homebrew shop and picked up some ingredients and started to make beer in 1969, pretty crude. I at that point only had some old British textbooks to take a look at, and that was right about the time that Fred Eckhart came out with a treatise of lager brewing, and Dave Lyne's big book of brewing came out. So there were starting to be a couple of publications for more serious home brewers. And so I dug into those and moved to Chico in 1972 to study chemistry, and took my home brewing stuff with me, and continued to make beer at home. And then in 76, I opened a homebrew supply store in downtown Chico. And ran that for a couple years, and actually went down and visited Fritz Maytag, and then when Jack McAuliffe opened up in Sonoma, went and visited him, and said, "Man, I think I want to be a brewer for my career." So I put the homebrew shop up for sale and started writing a business plan in 1978, and went and spent quite a bit of time at UC Davis, which was just down the road, talking with Michael Lewis and a number of the grad students who were in the program, who later ended up going to Anheuser-Busch or whatever. But got some guidance and spent quite a bit of time in the brewing library at Davis, and sort of self-taught myself what there was to know about technical brewing and professional brewing, and in Nevada, sort of stick by stick and tank by tank. In 1980, we started making beer commercially. That's sort of in a nutshell my background.
Perfect. There's one little rabbit hole I need to poke my head in real quick. You said that you opened up a homebrew shop in 1976, correct?
Right. Correct.
To my knowledge, homebrewing wasn't made legal until 1979 by Jimmy Carter. Does that mean that you were kind of supplying the criminal homebrewers at the time?
Yes, homebrewing was not technically legal, although I'm not aware of anybody being arrested for it, at least after prohibition. There was a group called Wineart, which I think originated out of Canada, and they had done a pretty big push to push beer and winemaking. And there were a few notable shops in the Bay Area, Wine of the People and the Oak Barrel Winecraft, and so the Home Wine Shop down in Southern California. And I remember there being a few other homebrew shops or wine and beer shops that were selling ingredients. So it was starting to be more popular, I guess, that we start seeing fresh hops and a few things start showing up in the 70s. But before that, I mean, home brewing, you could buy malt extract, I remember, at the hardware store, and some drug stores carried packages of these terrible, I'm sure they were cluster variety hops that were compressed into a little pink package. It was actually Hollingberry and Sons who were producing that. And those hops were sold for home brewing, so there was supplies available from a number of sources.
And were those hops, were all the little lupulin glands that are falling out in the bottom of the bag, were they orange or were they still yellow?
Well, actually, worse than that. So the those little pink bricks were really intended for bread baking in Africa. And it turns out that the hops had a use in some culinary past as a bacteria inhibitor to use in bread baking. And where that tradition came from, I don't know, but you can Google it and find a little bit of history of hops being used in the yeast starter that was for bread. And so he had found this market segment. I'm not sure if it's still going or not. And they really didn't want hops that had flavor or character. They just wanted some alpha acids. And I remember him, Hollingberry, telling me a story of 1 year. He would send 2, 3, 5-year-old hops. He would compress them into little bricks. And that's what was ending up in the homebrew trade at the time. So terrible hops. And he made a comment that one time he ran out of old hops and he sent fresh hops down to Africa and they were rejected because they had way too much odor. And, so we unfortunately, as home brewers back in there, that's the quality of raw material we were sort of seeing on the shelf.
That sounds like a one of those back in my day stories, and we were happy. is that yeah. The sum of it? So you just talked about your history of that, but I've had the opportunity to speak with people like Gary Fish of Deschutes Brewery or John Meyer from Rogue and many other people who are just prominent icons in the brewing industry today. And when the subject has come up of their first favorite beer or beers that inspire them, many of the times it all goes back to your beers at Sierra Nevada. And my question for you, Ken, is what was your inspiration in the beginning? What was the beer bug that just grabbed you and wouldn't let go?
Well, as I mentioned, I sort of grew up with fermentation. The sights and smells were sort of deeply entrenched in me from a very young age, from when I was like 6. So I don't know if that sort of put the whole notion of brewing sort of into my psyche just because I was around it and I loved the smells and the work boiling on the stove and so Cal had rows of fermenters down their service porch and he eventually built a cold room and again pretty serious home brewer for back in the 60s. But I did get intrigued with the science of brewing as well. So I studied chemistry and I worked in a chem lab and I took biology and physics. And so I was sort of a science nerd and fan. I think that was part of it. And then I've been a baker and cheese maker. We had goats for many, many years. And I liked producing things with my own hands. And so I think that was part of it as well. Back in the early 70s when I was home brewing, I was malting some of my own grains. I was malting wheat because you couldn't buy malted wheat readily back in that era. I was roasting my own black malts and black barley to make stouts. So I'd like the hands-on aspect of brewing from very early on.
Gotcha. Well, I want to dive in a little bit into the meat and potatoes that I really wanted to chat with. And there's a couple other things I'll bring up when we get there. But I think one of the biggest things I wanted to talk to you about, just because of your tenure in the beer business, everything, was just the concept of challenge. And I first met you at the Resilience Beer Fest in Bend, Oregon. That was basically a fundraiser where all the local breweries got together and brewed essentially from the same recipe but had their own take on it. And that was a fundraiser for, and forgive me if I have this wrong, but a fundraiser for Paradise, the town that...
Well, not specifically for Paradise. That's the main area that was affected, but really the foothill communities that were burned out
okay.
in the campfire. So it was more than just Paradise.
Okay.
There were a couple other...
Okay, perfect. But of course, I remember just looking at the social media online, and I mean, there were pictures of the Sierra Nevada facility, and the fires came really, really close. And having worked in the fire business once upon a time, I know how I can appreciate how dire that must have been down there. But the, you know, that was a whole concept of challenge. If it's okay, I want to go back to the beginning. And you kind of mentioned that you're dealing with hard to find ingredients or getting low quality ingredients, and technically being, you know, maybe homebrewing was illegal but unenforced. In the early days of trying to start professional brewing and you know, back in the day when, you know, when Bud Light had not even come out yet, to my recollection, what were your biggest challenges that you had to face when you decided, hey, let's go pro and make some really good, interesting beer?
Well, you know, I guess going to the brewing side, you know, there was no small brewing manufacturers like we have today. I mean, you can buy little fermenters today and, you know, little brew houses and everything really to support an upstart brewer. You know, we probably could have gone to Europe and found somebody who was knowledgeable about building small brewing equipment, but it would have been so far out of our budget that it would not have allowed us to get into business the way we did. So everything was home built. So, you know, that was a pretty big struggle. It took a long time, and our budget was so limited that, you know, we ended up doing, you know, I did all the plumbing. I took refrigeration repair classes at the junior college so I could do all the refrigeration work. I did all the electrical wiring in the building with a friend who was an electrician. I did all the welding, weld the tanks together. So that in itself was a pretty big struggle. And I had sort of followed Jack McAuliffe's approach and tried to build, you know, everything, including the malt mill, I built from scratch. And it was a lot of work just to, you know, put that all together, let alone, you know, figuring out how to brew in the equipment and propagate our own yeast. There weren't, you know, yeast labs that would sell slurries. You could buy plants, but you couldn't buy pitchable quantities. And the dry yeast that were available were pretty low quality out of Europe and really intended for home brewing or Red Star yeast out of really a bakery strain more than a beer strain. So the sourcing ingredients was a bit challenged. I wouldn't say that was the biggest hurdle. There were maltsters that were willing to sell to a small brewer. I went down to pick the malt up myself at Bauer Schweitzer Malting in San Francisco and drove my 57 Chevy flatbed back down there with a couple of bins on it. And they were, you know, used to filling rail cars, and I pulled in with a couple of tote-sized bins, and they filled them up, which took all of about 2 seconds with a 24-inch spout coming out of their silo. So I could get pale malt initially in San Francisco from the maltster. They only lasted a couple of years before they shut the facility down, and then it was Great Western in Los Angeles, and when they closed, it was Great Western in Vancouver. And then Specialty Malts, Breitz was up and running, so and we bought roasted malts from them, and then Canada Malting had a roaster. And then sourcing hops, as a homebrew shop owner, I was making annual treks to Yakima, so I had connections in Oregon and Washington both. So we were able to, you know, source hops. So on the production side, you know, lots of challenges, lots of learning, but nothing totally insurmountable. And then, you know, the market and sales side was all new to us as well. And that was probably as big of a challenge, was just to, you know, get the product onto, you know, shelves so that, you know, the few customers that were looking for something different had an option. And so it was educating initially just retailers. We went direct to self-distribution from the brewery to retailers in Chico on-premise and liquor stores, and some grocery stores were willing to stock it. And then as we expanded, it was then convincing the distributor to want to carry the beer. And, you know, there was no craft industry. I mean, Fritz was out there sort of pioneering. And Jack had, I think he had self-distributed everything. And then there were really only a couple other brewers operating, small brewers operating in the U.S. So plowing new just getting acceptance from all the cheers to even try the beer. Quite frustrating some days. And you'd go to 20 bars and liquor stores and not one would take the beer in. So I remember getting an account was a huge win just to get somebody to want to stock it on their shelves. So that was pretty rough, those early years, just kind of build the awareness.
And how long did it take for consumers to finally come around and realize, wow, this stuff is different and really good, and I want to continue buying it?
You know, and we started just in Chico, and, you know, we're in a college town, so there was a fair amount of young people around, and there was a handful of progressive bars and restaurant owners that, you know, wanted to support the hometown beer. So it was slow, but we had, I guess our first year was pretty much only in Chico, and then as we realized that we weren't making enough money to survive and we better expand, then we went down to the Bay Area, and that was more challenging, but we were quite fortunate to get Chez Panisse to put a beer on pretty early on, and that was in a place we could show other retailers and other restaurant owners that here's this progressive restaurant in Berkeley that's serving our beer. And so that allowed us then to, you know, get more on premise accounts. Back in that era, draft beer was not a real thing for imports, or you know, the domestic beers that you'd find on draft were normally sort of loss leaders for them. They would sell a keg of beer for about $20. And for a small brewer like us, you know, we needed to get more money than that. We would have never been able to stay alive. So we didn't even do draft the first couple of years, just because there were very few bars that had multiple taps. And again, the expectation was that beer would be pretty cheap to the bar owner. So we priced ourselves at about what the imports were selling at, about 85 cents a bottle, and we were not able to afford six packs for our first year and a half or so. So it was just individual bottles, which again doesn't help much for velocity. But, you know, just sell singles, but that was the only we could do in the beginning.
Well, we've certainly come a long way, haven't we? I look at the prices of higher end kegs or even higher end bottles. I've paid $20 to $30 for bottles of some really primo stuff, but I mean, yeah, just to, you know, and that's not even the highest priced stuff out there too. So, wow, that's amazing.
The bars that were receptive tended to be like Irish bars, because they were used to paying, you know, if they didn't have draft, they'd have Guinness, and you know, so you know, as we decided to get into draft, as there started to be some multi-tap accounts out there, you have to be, you know, in that kind of an account that was willing to spend the upfront money for a more expensive keg.
Hmm. Well, so let's fast forward roughly 40 years to get to where we are now. And despite the challenges of natural disasters and wildfires, you have such a legacy so far, and such a great brand recognition. I'm kind of curious, what are the challenges that you are that your brewery and you are dealing with today in today's beer climate?
You know, I think it's not just Sierra Nevada. I think the majority of the brewers that have been around for a number of years, you know, Deschutes and you know, Boston and New Belgium, and you sort of rattle off dozens of brewers that have, you know, started up in the 80s or early 90s, and you know, are all facing the same kind of market challenges with, the big local movement of you know, breweries and tap rooms being pretty much now in almost every town across the country, and in some towns like Bend, I mean, dozens of breweries, and Asheville the same way. Chico's got a handful now. For many years, we were the only brewer, but we've got a five or six of them operating now. So there's a lot of options for people. There's a lot of great beer out there, a lot of brand and affinity for your local brewers, and us as a national brewer, so we're competing with the favorite person who everybody knows in town, and so there's that aspect. I think we're all just trying to figure out how to grow all of our businesses and keep the consumer satisfied with what we're producing and what we're doing as companies. So the marketplace is not the market is not growing double digits like it did for many, many years. So we've got a pie with more pieces every day, and got the same amount of drinkers.
Yeah, it seems just from the time that I've been paying attention, you just mentioned that we have well over 7,000 breweries in the nation now, and there are some that are not producing as good of beer as others, but for the most part, just brewing knowledge in general has gotten pretty high, and consumer knowledge of good beer has gotten a little bit better than it used to be, and so it's easy to find good beer is kind of my point, but there's so much of it out there. It just seems like there's a general overwhelm with consumers as far as I don't even know what to pick. I mean, in some cases I see people grabbing the good old fashioned standbys, but there's also just this craze for finding what the newest and the latest and the greatest. And do you find that you have grown your brewery to become not only a national brewery with a brewing facility out South Carolina or North Carolina?
North Carolina.
North Carolina. But to my knowledge, you've also reached internationally as well. Do you find that being big or having that much reach has created its own set of challenges?
Well, I mean, certainly, as the company has grown to, we have over 1,000 employees with our on-premise pubs and the tap room in Berkeley and quite a large pub and restaurant in Mills River, North Carolina. It's a different business than when I was brewing all the beer myself and bottling all of it myself. We've got now, certainly other battles to wage just in managing this big of an operation. Certainly growth has got its positives and negatives.
Well, and with just kind of like the big trend of people looking for the newest and the latest and greatest, do you find that just being a larger brewery, do you find it harder or easier to actually come up with new stuff and get it out in the market?
It's probably easier in some ways, and we do more than 100 different beers every year, and we have for quite a few years. We've got small brewing facilities at both breweries, so we have a half barrel brew house in Chico, we've got a 10 barrel brew house, we've got a 100 barrel and a 200 barrel, and out in North Carolina, we've got a 20 barrel and a 200 barrel. So we're constantly innovating, and we've got an innovation team that's always brewing up fun and interesting beers. So we're constantly doing that. Not too many of those make it into wide distribution, though. So most of those beers stay at our tap rooms or are used just for R&D purposes. And we do a lot of research around hops and yeast and malt, and so we're quite involved in that side of innovation as well. So I think having the tools and resources and equipment allow us to be pretty creative and do a lot of fun stuff. On the other hand, we can't take all those brands into the market. There's just not the interest from our distribution partners or retailers to put 100 new SKUs on. They're already getting inundated with thousands of new SKUs a year coming at them. They can't support them all.
Sure.
So I think it's not a detriment as far as being big to
I had the privilege of interviewing Caitlin Landisberg for this podcast, and she, as you well know, but for my listeners' sake, she started a brewery called Sufferfest Brewing, where I thought it was absolutely brilliant, but she did gluten-removed beers, but they catered to athletes and even started adding some, for lack of a better word, some adjuncts, but I think, if I recall correctly, I kidded her about making the Gatorade of beer. Did you? But that was a brewery that Sierra Nevada recently acquired. And if I have my facts wrong, please let me know. But that was the first acquisition that you had made of another brewery? Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah.
And
Caitlin was here yesterday. So she's spending quite a bit of time with our team, and we've ramped up, and we've been brewing the beers here for the last 6 weeks or so. She's an athlete and a runner herself, and really built her business around the needs or the desires of outdoor exercise fitness. And so typically lower alcohol and with some functional benefit to the mm-hmm. products that, whether it's herbs or minerals or something that it may be of interest to some consumers.
And I thought that was an interesting move, and it may have been absolutely brilliant. I'm waiting to see for sure, but... was the acquisition of that brewery in response of a challenge that's out there? And part of that question really is, with your R&D capabilities and, being able to create 100 new beers a year, why did you choose to bring Sufferfest into the fold as to just going out and creating your own?
We thought that, Caitlin and her whole team came over, so they're walking the talk. Most of her staff are true athletes, and she's got her tribe. So that was part of the appeal, and I think she had created a brand platform that was pretty unique and different from Sierra Nevada, and to try to add those styles to Sierra Nevada's portfolio, we thought might be a little too broad for maybe our Sierra Nevada consumers, and we wanted to have a platform where we could be a little bit, more experimental in a different way than we would normally under a Sierra Nevada banner.
Hmm. No, I thought what she was doing was brilliant, and I expect that move will pay off. But I'm looking forward to seeing more out of that. And they actually sent me some packages of the beer that they had at the time, and I was impressed. I mean, I knew it was gluten removed, and so I had a expectation of what it would taste like, and when I actually tasted it and spent the time to think about it and really evaluate it, I don't know that I would have been able to tell that it was gluten removed if I didn't know it going into the glass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Charlie Bamforth actually worked with Caitlin on recipe development. Mm. Charlie's an old friend and now works with us at the brewery.
So she had a ringer working with her then.
Yeah.
Yep. That's the current state of affairs. But if I can ask you to look into your crystal ball or your crystal glass of beer, as we move forward in the next few decades of beer, what do you see coming down the pike as far as the challenges that we're going to have to deal with?
Well, I think if the continuation of breweries is going to happen. I'm not sure where the right number is for how many brewers can survive and doing what styles, and they may be not anything we recognize today as sort of mainstream styles coming in the next 10 or 20 or 30 years. on the health aspect, or I guess the trend towards lower alcohol and maybe things like gluten for your gluten-reduced products. So I think that's going to continue. You know, the spectrum of what's hot and popular right now is evolving at a tremendously fast rate with the alcoholic waters and CBD and probably at some point THC products getting mixed in, the alternative beverages, kombucha and other fermented kinds of beverages that are close to the beer space. I think that's going to continue to grow. Just a tremendous evolution. I mean, hops are still hot, and IPAs are still sort of where the craft drinker generally goes towards. But we're seeing lower alcohol sours and other styles emerging. So I think the innovation side is going to be there. You know, the beer industry in general is not super healthy. You know, there's not a lot of growth across most of the segment. There are certainly some brands that are still doing well. You know, beers imported from Mexico seem to still be finding a pretty solid niche. But, in general, beer, wine, spirits, sort of trading dollars, the amount of drinkers is not growing at the same rate as people's consumption habits are slowing down a little bit. So overall flatness in the segment, I don't know that that's going to dramatically change in the next 10 or 20 years. I don't see a big upswing in alcoholic consumption happening. So we're just going to have to figure out how to keep delighting consumers and satisfying their wants and needs in a variety of ways that may not be the type of products we're producing today, or there'll probably be a place for those always, but I think there'll be a lot of innovation in the next few years.
Well, it's kind of interesting to me is I saw that according to the Nielsen data that American Pale Ales have taken the number 2 spot, and which I'm sure has been very good for you, but I thought that was surprising because pale ales seem to have waned over the past 20 years or so. If everything truly is cyclical, like bell bottoms coming back to become boot cut jeans or something like that, do you think some of those classic styles will make a resurgence of like ambers and browns and reds and dunkels and stuff like that?
Yeah, to some degree. I don't think that we're going to see everybody switching over to pale ales, but I do see a lot of brewers, craft brewers, entering the market with sessionable lager styles. We've been making some for a number of years, but I think drinkability is going to be important in a long term balance. And I see there being a bifurcation of the marketplace with the consumers who want a hop wallop and high alcohol, and then other consumers who maybe want hop flavor and aroma and not much bitterness and lower alcohol, also having a growth area. So I don't know that one style will dominate as much as IPAs or hoppy beers, and I don't think that the consumer is going to go back to not liking hoppy beers, maybe less bitter beers, but I think now that hops are pretty entrenched in the craft consumer's palate, that I don't see that drinker walking away from hoppy beers.
One other thing I want to find out about, we've talked pretty much all about beer, but it seems that sustainability is another thing that seems to be important besides just making really good beer and getting it out there. What are your thoughts and advice to brewers and the consumers about keeping things sustainable for the future?
As brewers, I think we have an obligation. We do use a lot of resources to make beer, whether it's the water that goes into growing hops or barley and malting grain and the energy into cans or glass packaging and transportation, and then, you know, obviously all the production inputs. The industry, I think, has done a good job at identifying, you know, that we need to be good stewards of our resources. You know, the amount of water used by breweries has dramatically been reduced over the years, and it continues to generally go down, although small brewers typically, you know, are less efficient than bigger brewers as far as being able to put in recovery systems and just how, you know, the batch sizes and the number of CIPs and all those kinds of things are advantageous in a larger format. But, you know, we've put a lot of emphasis in that area over the years. We've got 10,000 solar panels in Chico we've had in for quite a few years, and we have on-site big composting systems and a lot of energy and heat recovery projects over the years we've done. And then in North Carolina, we went and built to LEED Platinum standards the whole facility, not just offices or warehouses, but all the production areas as well. I think we were maybe one of the first to certify the whole brewing process and get it LEED certified, which was quite an endeavor to go through all that. But we've got, you know, very efficient and nice operation because of it. But I do think it's important, and most craft brewers seem like they're of the same sentiment, that you know, it's important to be good stewards of the resources we're using.
Well, and being no stranger to challenge, I'm sure building that facility in North Carolina was just another day.
No, it was more than another day.
Was it?
Years of planning and construction, and it was a complete greenfield site. There was nothing there, so we had to put in roads, bridges, wells, power infrastructure, wastewater treatment plant. It was a significant project for us, and I've done a lot of construction over the years and expanded Chico dozens of times from 10-barrel batches to where we are today. But it was the biggest undertaking by far that I've had to do, and was more complicated by far than I had imagined, and harder. So it was a pretty significant chunk of my life to, you know, from 2010, sort of the inception of the project, breaking down and ground in 2012 to getting the thing completed a few years later. Those of you who haven't been out there, I'd welcome to take a tour. It's a Asheville area is quite vibrant beer scene. A lot of breweries, a lot of innovation, a lot of food and culture and arts. So it's a great place to visit and a great brewing community.
Well, and another guest on the podcast is a advanced cicerone that gives tours out there, and he talked about how it was just a wonderful partnership when Sierra Nevada came in, and it was welcomed by all the locals. And I've also spoken with John Hall, and he said that that facility is just like Disneyland for beer lovers, and so I'm looking forward to getting out there myself. But anyone listening, from my understanding, it sounds like just a wonderful place to go to have a beer.
It is. Yep, I'm heading out there next week myself.
Ken, after all this time and after everything you've done, what still excites you about beer?
A lot of things. I still very much enjoy the hands-on aspect of the brewing science, the production. I still go to Yakima every year. I'm still involved in weekly meetings talking about new beers and styles, and the nuts and bolts of making beer still excites me. You know, the business side has got its challenges, and I spend much more time in the office than I would like. But growing up in this industry for 40 years now, I've seen a lot and made plenty of mistakes and hopefully done enough things right that they haven't been too significant. But I still enjoy getting up every day and coming to the brewery and the smells and walking around and seeing beer being made.
Fantastic. So I'm going to begin our kind of a wind down question series, but if you were anointed king of the beer world for a day, Ken, what would you change? What would you do?
Wow. I think the industry has come a long, long way with quality and consistency and education. I've been involved with the Brewers Association for many, many years, and that was always a concern. And I lived through some periods where not everybody was making great beer, and certainly not everybody today is making great beer, but the level of knowledge and understanding and appreciation of craft has really grown significantly, and try to ensure that people who do get into this business get into the right reason, and that people do pay attention to making a consistent quality product day in and day out. And it's not easy for those of us in the industry. It's a daily battle with all the things we have to manage, from the raw material side to the health of the yeast, and it's something you can't take your eyes off for really a minute without potentially having something creep in that was unexpected. So I think just to make sure that the people in this industry are true stewards of the craft of making beer and try to pay attention to the details because they do matter.
If you had the opportunity to choose your very last meal and your very last beer, what would they be?
My very last meal. So I love to eat and I love to cook. And I don't know that I've got one particular dish or meal that I would say I've got to have before I die. But, I think something fresh out of my garden and something probably that I caught myself. I'm actually going fishing later this week. I enjoy fishing in the ocean and catching my own fish. So I would say a fresh caught fish dinner, some great fresh vegetables, and then some homemade pasta.
And what about the last beer?
Now, that's a tough one. I'd say our pale ale, depending on what time of year I get my last meal choice, it could be our celebration ale. Would be probably those would be my two choices.
Excellent. And then with the summation of your time in the beer business and experiences, why do you think good beer matters?
I've seen the evolution of the consumer go from just accepting that beer was a sort of flavorless, carbonated beverage to today. The consumer's appreciation and knowledge, and part of it is certainly the internet and information availability. But I think people's sensibilities about what they eat and drink have changed, at least in most parts of the country, pretty dramatically. And there's a much greater appreciation for flavors and complexity of what we eat and drink. So, I think we've been part of that whole revolution, and it's happened across bread, cheese, wine, beer. I mean, we all sort of have seen a shift in the consumer appreciation away from Wonder Bread and sort of the homogeneity of where food was headed in the 50s and 60s. So I think good beer is part of that good living experience of being able to really put things in your body that give pleasure in a number of ways, both how it tastes and then in your head how you feel about what you eat and drink.
I love it. Thank you. If any listeners want to learn a little bit more about you or some of the work that Sierra Nevada is doing, besides the wonderful beer, where could they go to connect and learn more?
Well, I wrote a book a few years back called Beyond the Pale, and I think it's still available on Amazon. It's got, you know, a bit more of my story. It's right up until well, I was in the middle of Bilton Mills River when I wrote the book, which was not a wise idea to add that to my plate, but so there's quite a bit of history in there.
Okay, and what is the website for the brewery as well? So people can go take a look at Chico and...
Yep, SierraNevada.com, quite simple.
Very simple, wonderful. And then last question, Ken, do you have any final words of wisdom?
Well, you know, I think that you know, the world right now for the drinker is probably as good as it's ever been. You know, consumers got lots of great experiences to be had around the beers we drink, and you know, I think just trying to make sure that as brewers we keep those consumers excited and enjoying what we produce. So we need to pay attention to the drinkers that we all love and need to have be part of our success.
Great. Thank you so much. I am, Ken, I'm so grateful to have this time to spend with you and to ask you all these questions and kind of get a little bit more insight with your experience. I feel like I could talk to you for hours, but I know you're a busy man. But thank you so much for coming on to the Good Beer Matters podcast.
I enjoyed it. Look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Awesome. I look forward to having a beer with you in the future, preferably in Mills River.
All right. Sounds good.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Challenge has been a constant companion throughout the history of brewing. Because of challenges, we have styles like IPAs and Imperial Stouts. Happy accidents brought us Icebox and perhaps Wild Ales. Between you and me, I'm looking forward to seeing what challenges force us to come up with next. Join us in the next episode when we visit a brewery in Hawaii that is changing the way we do things for the better. Good Beer Matters is a show about great beer, great friends, and the experiences we create together. But it's also about better appreciation of the beer you enjoy. I believe better education leads to better enjoyment. So if you're a beer and food professional or even a beer enthusiast, then please subscribe to Good Beer Matters and visit me at goodbeermatters.net. After that, grab a beer, hang out with friends, and let the world open up. Thank you for listening. Cheers.